It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey. Wow, midsummer already. Can you believe it?
Yeah, well, you see, there's some June gloom and it's July. I don't get this. This is what you like.
Okay, let's back up a minute. Did you like last week better? It was
you know what?
90 degrees here and 89% humidity. Did you like that?
If I can wear shorts and a t-shirt, yes. I absolutely love it.
I believe you're wearing shorts and a t-shirt today.
I know.
And you're telling
me. So I would like it a little better to be warmer. It's when I have to like dress up and be in the adult world that I really don't like the heat.
You know what? The high is 69 degrees today. And the sun's not out at 11:45. I think it's amazing.
And it was drizzly this morning.
Amazing.
Wow. The spirit of the Pacific Northwest here.
These are the days I thrive. I love it. My bedroom was...
You're thriving in Newbury Park on a nice little...
My bedroom with open windows was 64 degrees this morning. Oh, it's just perfect.
I don't like humid weather.
No, that was bad.
I don't like humid weather.
It's coming back next week.
Carmageddon too.
Well, Carmageddon, another issue, but it's gonna get hot here again and humid, and I'm going to cool off in where? North Carolina.
No, you're not.
Oh boy, that was dumb.
Put on your humidity temperature hat.
Yeah, unfortunately I got invited to North Carolina in the July, so I'm gonna go hang out with some Charlotte folks.
How are you gonna handle Carmageddon? Are you?
I'm not leaving my house.
You're leaving your house?
For those that don't know, there's a major freeway in LA shutting down this weekend.
There's an artery that's completely blocked. This city, this megatropolis, is going to have a profound heart attack.
Friday night to Monday morning. Yeah. And it's the major way we get from this area of the Southern California to almost anywhere else. Yeah. So
anywhere.
Fortunately, it's a major weekend. It's a major golf tournament in golf. And I'm going to park myself on a couch.
On your rusty, dusty lawn.
And I'm
going to
watch some golf, and I'm going to read, and I'm going to have a wonderful weekend, and I'm going to keep my eye on my traffic app.
I guess I'm going like, you know what? I love you. You're on your own. I'm not picking you up.
Oh.
Get a rental car and find your way north, or get a helicopter, but I'm not doing that thing.
My kids have to come home from Orange County on Saturday.
Oh!
I don't know how they're going to do that. And then one of them is supposed to go back Sunday to downtown L.A.
They're going
to
swim.
They had all these things arranged before, and they've already paid for things, and they couldn't.
Oh, wow.
So they're going to, I will find out. Hopefully everyone else is scared to death and staying home so they can get around town, but I don't think so. People aren't that bright, unfortunately.
The only time L.A. doesn't have traffic is Sunday morning.
No, I know. Sunday morning is a great time to run around this city.
It's like,
it is.
What's up with that? This is 24/7, 2 in the morning, any day, you're going to get traffic. But Sunday morning...
I find driving to the airport at 4 a.m. It's a 45-minute run. It's fabulous at 4 a.m. It's a three-hour drive at 8 o'clock in the morning, but yeah.
Woo-hoo.
That's the time to go.
All right, so you've been to Spain, England, and Rome, and like Paul, we were delayed in getting to Rome.
We are delayed. We did.
Did Agabus show up and tell you a prophecy that says you shouldn't go?
We got shipwrecked in Spain.
Yeah?
That was a problem.
Yeah?
No, Jim got to Rome on time, on schedule, and that was just...
Did you like it?
I loved it.
You loved it?
But not just for Italian culture and, you know, all that. It was just the history, walking back through... history 2,200 years ago, looking at the whole Roman church, going to the Vatican, St. Peter, St. John's. Yeah, I mean, it was just, we probably walked 10, 12 miles a day because we're just too cheap for cabs, I guess. And we met Silvio from a previous podcast and his wife Dominique, and who was out here a year ago, and we met them. He's an Italian-Swiss, but never been to Rome. So we got there and met them, and then we just started walking. We'd just go for a walk, and we'd just see the sights. And it was amazing. I not so much, you know.
You don't use the word amazing often.
I don't. I was amazed.
What were you amazed at?
Human history.
Yeah.
Yeah, I should have paid more attention when I was in college to humanities. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of stuff got by. I remember these pictures. I'd see stuff going.
Hey, wait a minute. I've seen that before.
I remember this picture in my humanities book, but it wasn't on the test, so I don't know a thing about it because I was a study for the test kind of guy. I refused to let learning get in the way of my education. So. So I'm reading now. Before I left and while I was there, I'm reading a whole history of the Roman Empire. And it was a newer one, and a fabulous look at history. So I'm reading that while I'm actually walking in the places where these things happen. And then over there, I got so intrigued by papal history that I got a good papal history book written a couple years ago. And I'm actually reading now, I'm up to the Middle Ages, I'm reading through all the history of the popes and how they became pope and how the Vatican became what the Vatican is, how papal authority became what it was, and I am finding all of that amazing.
Yeah?
From an evil side of things.
I sort of figured, yeah, somewhere the maniacal part's going to come in.
Oh, gosh, no, it's really here's the thing. Here's the...
Educate me on papal history. I know some, but...
Here's the abstract on what Rome meant to me. The Roman Empire actually folded into the Roman Church.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it is a big uh-oh. You're going all the priorities, and even to this, and I say, well, that's down on Catholic. No. It's in the Baptists, the Pentecostals, the Vineyards.
They all fold back in.
It all folds into the same thing. Authority, preoccupation with buildings and opulent buildings. I think it's hilarious. What the Crystal Cathedral out here has gone bankrupt. And the Catholic diocese is taking it over. I'm going, okay, that wouldn't surprise me a lot. But
family feud over the Crystal Cathedral.
Oh, it's ripped the family apart, and now they're even going to sell it to a university that's talking about using it as an extension campus, or a Catholic diocese is looking into getting it. And I thought they were out of money after all that, you know, money they had to pay to settle some things.
We got a furled brow here from Wayne on that one.
Yeah. But you go back to the very beginning of this, and I'm trying I've been through the first day we spent in the Roman Forum. It's all the Roman ruins from the history of that, and I've been reading about the violence. And when an emperor comes to power, he's got to slaughter the families of the other rival emperors as well as the family from the previous emperor if he's not related. And the same thing goes on in the Roman Catholic Church for at least the first 1,000 years that I'm reading. We're not doing it now, but they were doing it back then, fighting over who gets to really be pope, and you got to kill the rivals. Well, at the time, they weren't priests. Early on, they weren't priests because the bishops from other domains weren't considered for being the bishop of Rome. And what makes you pope is you're the bishop of Rome. You don't become the pope. You become the bishop, and thus the bishop of Rome. You become the bishop. Even today, the Pope Benedict was elected to be the bishop of Rome. That makes him the pope because the Rome is the dominant bishopric in the world. And they fought for that way back in the 3rd and 4th centuries. They're fighting to be over the bishop in Alexander, the bishop in Jerusalem, the bishop in Antioch, the bishop in... Yeah, they're fighting over who gets to be the lead bishopric and who gets to control what happens in the church. And this is 300-400 years after Christ is gone.
See, that does not seem very attractive to me, knowing what I know.
No, it doesn't.
I am actually very happy to...
Oh, but the reality is it's no different in any denomination you want to name. They haven't had 2,000 years to get all their cathedrals and everything built, but still the whole idea of your...
They would.
I heard this when we were planting a fellowship in Visalia, and we were meeting in rented quarters, and I heard this numerous times. You're not a real church in a city until you've bought property and built a building. Absolutely.
Who said that, Jim?
A number of denominations, that's what goes behind it. That's why...
That's legitimacy.
That's why they may start with home groups, whatever. And then you also have the reality that no human institution can work as a collaboration. Every human has to have someone in charge. I mean, the early church started by trying to be more collaborative. The reality is it leads to chaos unless someone is in charge, even if that someone is a horrible, evil... maniacal person who's executing people.
I do agree collaboration is hard to hold together.
It's fun for the moment, but it takes people committed to something bigger than themselves to make it
different.
To make it keep working. Anyway, and then you get to the Vatican on the second day. First day we're through the Forum and we're seeing all that and the pagan sculptures and all that stuff. And then we go to the Vatican the next day. And I was excited about the Vatican Museum. I thought there'd be a whole lot of important relics here from church history. It's not. It's Roman and Greek and Egyptian art that was stolen back in, they were protecting it from the destructive Vandals who were invading Rome. So it's just Roman history. It's the Roman emperor's statues and, you know, that Rome would love to have, but the Vatican has them because they were the last ones to get a hold of them to kind of keep them safe. And the Roman are ruins because everything in Rome
is in the Vatican.
Well, partly. They also say Rome is the city of 4 cathedrals and 1,000 churches. And I've got some pictures.
4 cathedrals and 1,000 churches.
Landscapes of Rome from a high point. And you can see dome after dome after dome after dome after dome after dome. I mean, there's churches built everywhere. And when the guy gave us the tour of the Roman Forum on Friday morning, he was saying, the Roman Colosseum, he goes, this was all made of white marble. And it's just old limestone rock that the birds are eating now. It's just going, this was a white, shining, marble-covered everything from every seat to every aisleway to every gallery was covered in. That's what they called Rome the Shining City because that white made the city glow and all their temples.
I bet that was hard to walk through on a sunny day.
Well, it might have been. and they were there for 12 hours. And you know why they had the Colosseum? Because the only way the Roman emperors could keep the people pacified, two things you have to give people to pacify them. You have to give them food and entertainment.
Right.
And you give them food and entertainment, they don't care. And so when the Roman emperor is getting to be disliked and his approval rating is going down, he holds 10 more days of whatever down at the Roman Colosseum, and everybody gets in free, and they kill all these animals and people, and then they toss the animal meat in little wooden things back to the people, so they get food and entertainment. And it's a great deal. It's a great deal.
You know what? Gladiator was actually one of my absolute favorites.
I know it is. I know that and Braveheart. You're a violent man. You're a violent, violent man. I know this. You like men in skirts who do violence. That's what I've concluded about you.
Wow. That's a different take on that, you know?
That's not how you've seen it?
I never saw it from that vantage point, but all right. And then I like blue ones on foreign planets. That's also a good one.
I'm thankful we haven't talked about that in years.
Okay.
It's passed. Even the culture's passed it, which is fabulous. But go back. Why was Gladiator one of your favorite movies?
You know the coolest thing?
The coolest
was when
people die and geese.
Maximus and Marcus Aurelius are having this moment that's, you know.
Maximus is now a horse in Tangled.
Whatever. So in this movie, he was a guy in a skirt that was very good at killing people. Okay. But they were talking about, let's be like men who dreamed. And they talked about the dream that was Rome. And I got to tell you, when I listened to that, I started to tear up because it was in language of allegory and parable that is the same dream that I got to believe is Jesus' desire for the church. And it's the same language of ecclesia. I mean, I heard something totally different in that movie that totally rocked me. Because it was like, The desire to turn this back to the people, and how Maximus was going like, no, I don't want to know. But that's exactly why you've got to be the one. It's because he didn't have ambition. He didn't want the place and the privilege. It wasn't his to rule. It was the desire to turn this back to the power of the people, that it would be theirs. And I just...
Okay, back to reality.
I love that moment. I just went, oh, yes!
Be a great moment. No one like that was in Rome.
No, but... no. There is that longing, and I...
No, I hear you. The longing
is valuable. I have that deep inside me somehow ingrained with a sense of, you know what? There is a day and a time, there is somewhere in all of this when people are not going to just corrupt all of it towards their ends, and where selfish ambition isn't going to rule the day, and where courage and humility are married in lives that help lead people to a place of freedom. I long for that. Those are the things that I'm going like, I want to get up on that day and keep marching toward that place.
I think that's great. It just wasn't in Rome. What we learned about Rome is really 1%.
I like that part of the movie.
1% of the population is living off the enslavement of 99%+ of the population.
Okay, so that kind of tarnishes that a little bit.
No kidding. Rome was definitely an elitist culture of those who lived near the Forum and paraded in their fancy little buildings and fought and killed each other when they were rivals for power. And then they would have to pacify the rest of the people, threaten them, drag them off to war. And most of why Rome conquered all that it conquered, why did they have this need to conquer everything? Because they would run out of money in Rome. See, this is what we can't do now. This is why the American economy is tanking and we can't fix it. In the Roman days, when they would be in this kind of economy,
go have a war and go get some more stuff.
They would go invade somebody and take all their stuff. They went to Egypt, took all their stuff. They went to Jerusalem, took all their stuff. They would just say, okay, we're short here and we can't keep living this extravagant lifestyle, this 1%. So we're taking the other 99% to war and thousands of those will die, but we'll bring back a whole new load of stuff that's going to drive our economy for another 50, 60 years. That's Rome.
See, I still think that's somewhere in the seeds of how economies work. Or don't work.
Well, they don't work now because it's tough to do. The Greeks would might be like to do it and invade somebody now. Or, you know, we're going to accuse of doing that in the Middle East to steal the oil. And that's why that's there, because that's been the known human tradition. And when the empire collapses,
Wow. The
only thing that's somewhat holding the world together is this Christianity, this Roman church. And so they become the power elite. They start anointing the king. Charlemagne being crowned at St. Peter's Basilica is one of those moments where the church, we're kind of in charge of this whole deal. But it was as cutthroat, as preoccupied with money and buildings and making people come under their authority as the Roman church had been. It's unbelievable. That's why it led to the Crusades eventually, which I haven't got to yet, but I'm kind of interested in rereading that whole thing.
When you look at that, and you look at the beginnings of the persecuted church in Rome and the going from house to house kind of deal. How did it get from there to that monster?
Well, you know, everybody puts that on old Constantine. Even the books I'm reading put it on him.
I know, but I don't know that that's all that fair. I'm going like, can we take a step back and not just, oh, that guy? Because I don't think you can pin it to a person.
Well, you can...
No, I mean, I know there's compelling arguments in terms of heathen, politicized, all that, but there's something in our soul that Constantine's not here today. And you can see this...
Oh, I hear you. Yeah.
I can see this played out in virtually every new denomination. Okay? I mean, that's where I'm going, like, it's not Constantine. It is in the human soul that we do this. It starts in the beauty of something that's unorganized, that is life-driven, and is gathered around more of a collegiality where Christ is the center and the king, and that's the source of the life.
Ooh, and that's enough. That's enough for everybody.
It is enough.
Yeah.
Why does it devolve into something that we administrate, legislate, and then hierarchate? I don't know a word.
What is that? Is that chocolate cake? What is a higher cake? My first thought was, why are you talking about chocolate cake? We've already talked about chocolate on this podcast.
No, but I do not know why people can't camp around the joy and the freedom and when Jesus really is in charge and life is flowing there. And they do. They administrate, they legislate, and then we stack it up in terms of who's in power and how do they run this. And I'm going like, why? What seeds are in the human soul that keep growing that tree?
Boy, do I have a quote for you.
Oh, hot.
Perfect timing.
Perfect timing. I had no idea.
We couldn't have scripted this better.
Well, because we're not scripting.
I know we're not, so we couldn't have.
Tell me.
This Kent sent me this, our friend from St. Louis area. Quote from Jacques Ellul. You know Jacques?
He's not well, but I know.
He's a wild thinker guy. Anyway, he said this, no matter what may be its form or level, it inevitably tends to enhance it. It's talking about any human organization. It inevitably tends to enhance itself and to initiate a movement towards centralization. No political power will ever reduce itself or accomplish decentralization. There is a law that power will grow without limit. The only recognized limit is fact. Power will always go as far as it possibly can, geographically or judicially. It ceases to expand only when it comes up against an obstacle that is more powerful than itself. Power is under the necessity of becoming absolute and totalitarian. This depends neither on the men who wield it, nor on the ideology, nor on the circumstances, and political power would not be power if this were not so. Now, that's a little bit of Lord of the Rings right there from Jacques Ellul. Power is itself corrupting. And so a group of this, we saw that here with one of the groups in town that, in a town nearby. I don't want to say who this is exactly. I've done some speaking for them at various times. They actually offered me to be their senior pastor at one point. But I don't identify who they are necessarily. But they celebrated their 50th anniversary not too long ago. And I remember the article in the paper was all about the joy of how it began with 12 people in a home, disaffected from the religious groups they've been a part of, wanting something more alive, more holy, more wonderful, more real, more relational. And they were still celebrating that 50 years later when they were anything but that. They're the opposite of that now. They are the big megalithic institution in that area, the biggest fellowship in town. And now it's just like they've totally gotten lost. But their nostalgia is still for that, what it was at the beginning. And they think we're still doing it now. How?
Am I a goofball to think that what Jacques Ellul wrote, that I can't like completely disagree, but I don't know that it has to end that way? Am I a goofball for?
Yeah, I think so.
Naively dreaming that, you know, let's be as men who dreamed.
Get your head out of that sand pit there, you ostrich. No, I love the dream. And I think.
See, that's what fires my soul is the fact that, you know, in spite of the tragedies that I have been a part of, where it's like that's proof that over and over and over and over, there's something in me that says, well, so that doesn't have to be the outcome. Well, I still want to try again.
He says it does.
I know, which is, I'm agreeing with that at the moment.
No, look what he's saying, though. It has to do with power. It has to do with the need for power. If the only way you're going to live in the dream you're talking about is to be a person that doesn't covet
need
it,
power.
Number one, doesn't utilize it, number two, number three, remains collegial in relationships.
Right.
If you can remain that, you will get to have that in a variety of your relationships in your life. But that doesn't mean somebody that you're collegial with.
I know, that's the problem.
Doesn't turn into the Emperor of Rome. In fact, I found out this in Rome. I've got to tell you.
Okay.
The title Pontiff Maximus was used of the emperors before it was used of the Pope.
Pontiff Maximus.
It means the high priest. The emperor was the high priest of Roman pagan society. When you go in the Sistine Chapel, and I forgot this.
Okay.
Do you want to finish this other thought
first?
I'm sorry. I'm going to get back lost in Rome.
You're excited. I don't see this often.
When in the Sistine Chapel, and that would be probably the thing I wanted most to see is the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel that Michelangelo
Adam
painted.
Adam reaching to God, yeah. Doing finger.
Two panels over from the Adam reaching God with a finger is a man mooning the floor. I'm not kidding you. I'm not kidding you.
Only you would see that one. Man mooning the floor. Explain.
You're not supposed to talk in the Sistine Chapel. So before we go into the Sistine Chapel, our guide, and this was great, Sarah and I paid for a tour of the Vatican, and we chose the smaller tour, 1 in 12, you know, 12 to 1 tour guide. But no one else signed up for our tour. It was the four of us with our guests and this guide, and she was amazing. So she's going over the Sistine Chapel. She got a big diagram outside, and we're going over what to look for and all. And I'm seeing this guy two panels down with this, looks like his butt. And I'm going, is that guy mooning the Pope? And she goes, no one's asked me that question before. Yeah, that's a guy with his toga up and his britches down. And he's just, and Michelangelo really didn't want to paint the chapel. So
that's Michelangelo.
Well, we don't know. There's nothing.
I'm thinking it is.
Nothing in history, but it kind of says to the Pope, "Pull on you." He didn't want to work on it. He did anyway. And I go. And the other thing, he worked on that 4 years by himself. No one else came in the chapel. No one else saw it till he was done. One.
That's how he was able to paint the guy mooning it.
I couldn't paint my bathroom in 4 years just white. I don't know how you get that.
I understand that.
Beautiful piece of art, and it is. It is incredible. It is incredible, and that they've restored it. The colors are so vibrant. I mean, it really is something to see. Absolutely. But then, a number of years later, he was commissioned by the Pope to come back, which, again, he didn't want to do, but he's going to paint the Last Judgment on the wall in front of him. And so he's painting the Last Judgment. This time, it's not closed. It's open. People are coming out, and there's one representative from the Pope who keeps coming in. picking at his art, saying, no, you shouldn't change this over here, change over here. And Michelangelo just kept ignoring him. He just kept doing what he wanted to do because he was commissioned to do it. He gets all the way down the bottom right-hand corner where he's painting the underworld, where all the damned gets the last judgment.
Look at that guy there.
All the damned. And the head man of the damned, the lord of the underworld, has this guy's face on it. And so the guy comes in, he sees it, and he's just enraged. He's yelling at Michael, you have to change. And he says, oh, that's the way it is. I'm not going to do it. And he goes, runs to the Pope and says, Pope, you've got to make him change it. He can't do it. And the Pope said, where's this again? Well, it's in the Last Judgment. It's the scene in the underworld. He goes, I'm the Pope. I have no authority in the underworld. He let it stay. It still has that guy's face on the painting. I think it's hilarious.
Ooh.
So anyway.
So Michelangelo's mooning the Pope.
But when I went in the Sistine Chapel, there's a part of me that wants to say, God, if you're in this place, this has been a place where people have allegedly come and prayed for years. And I just was wondering if me and God would have a moment in the Sistine Chapel. Because I was really thinking that'd be cool.
He'll reach down his finger, you'll reach yours up.
I didn't find it. It was very crowded, and he couldn't even move. But I stood in one little corner for a while, and I just said, I'm going to take this place in. Gaudy, ugly building. Take the ceiling off, the rest of it. It's just a plain rectangle. Everything is painted. Oh, and I forgot to tell you this. In the ceiling, around this whole creation of God and all that stuff going on, there's these various diamond or triangle-shaped things that he used to separate that whole thing. And in those are half of them have Old Testament prophets in it. So he's painted Ezekiel and Daniel and all these guys. Every other one is one of the goddesses of pagan Egypt. The prophetess.
What?
Yes. It's, you go,
what?
Whoa. Then you see, when you go in the Vatican Square outside St. Peter's, where they've got this huge obelisk with a cross on top, in the middle, all around that are designations of the zodiac signs.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, you realize.
I do know originally that did have a wonderful aspect to it before it got corrupted.
Well, it was all part of the pagan worship. And you see all throughout, whether it's in this room, that painting, this thing, it's a merging of paganism.
Mixture, amalgamation.
Yeah, and paganism won. It's not that Christianity is kind of, well, it's kind of there in a neat way. It's repulsive. When we go into St. Peter's and you look at this brass, whatever it is, over the central altar, the altar that only the Pope can celebrate Mass on. No one else can. It's his personal altar to celebrate at St. Peter. And it's got this huge bronze gazebo over it, you know?
Okay.
And you just feel the weight of it. You walk in there and you go, cool, man. The monstrosity, it's bigger inside than a football field. Huge marble column. It doesn't look all that big on the outside. It looks pretty much what you'd expect on TV, the scale of it. But when you go inside, it's just an overwhelming building built to, again, prove this is the Rome you can't resist. And it's amazing. So, and we kept, everywhere we went in Rome, we kept seeing scenes from Angels and Demons, the movie. So we got home and rented it so we could relive our time in Rome. All the fountains, all the churches, all the places we were, all the piazzas. It's the same place. But what amazes me, and I even went in St. Peter's, I got alone with near the Pieta, you know, the Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci, I forget who painted what, but it's that carving, it's that sculpture of Mary holding Jesus' body. It's an amazing, supposed to be the most incredible sculpture ever done kind of thing, and it is all that, but boy, trying to find some reality of God in that place, just trying to find a moment, a quiet moment, it's too the opposite of everything I believe. And like I said, for those of you who think that's anti-Catholic, I think the Baptists and Mormons and Vineyards and Calvary, they haven't been at it as long. So they don't have the same monstrosity. But still, people try to build these overly incredible buildings. And they have this, what you were talking about before I got back to the Sistine Chapel, the centralized power of authority. And I think, you know, to answer your earlier question, for me, I want to live in that city you talk about. That's how I treat people. That's how I work with people. But I have a realization now that not everybody wants to live in that as long as they benefit from it. And then there's people who, when they no longer benefit from it, they either want to own it or destroy it. And there's no way in this world I think you're going to get past that problem. You have to own it or destroy it.
Yeah. The only thing I would add to what Jacques Ellul wrote is I do think that there is a power from God that doesn't do that. But I think it has to be borne out in the life of someone like Christ. It's like if you're not committed to that, where it's like it's not power, it's power.
Well, it's
it's not the same order. It is something completely different.
I agree with you. But this is human power, and yeah. Human power seems to always overrun. Even, you look back through history, wonderful things that God began were overrun with human power.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing that I've experienced. I looked at, you know, back to the Gladiator movie, you have this...
Again?
Yes, you have Commodus that is this...
He's the emperor.
Little child, you know, child, son of the emperor. And he doesn't have any of the virtues that Maximus does, but he's going... But I have an ambition. You just go like, at the time that I was being fascinated with this, that's what I saw in the life of the church out of those who were ascending into, you know, sort of positions of prominence, being recognized for their gifting. You just go like, oh my gosh, this is people trying to derive their value, their worth by ascending in the rank and file of what's going on. It's like, this is terrible.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at that going like, no, your kingdom is upside down. It's like those who have, quote, the greatest gifts and the powers, like they're at the bottom of the pile serving.
Yeah, and
this is upside down.
Isn't the greatest test of that, though? I mean, it's easy to talk about not wanting, needing significance when you don't have it. And then when something starts coming into your life where you start to have it,
oh yeah.
Then you find out whether or not people really had ambition or really had a quest for seeing. Because it's easy for people to say, "I don't want it," when they don't have it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And then when they have it, and I think that's what you don't know about people. So you can start on this journey. You can love people. You can be collaborative. You can work together in wonderful ways and see God do amazing things. But I think it's often then you've got to let
it's not successful.
You've got to let go of it. Oh, you've got to let go of it. And let it be what it was, and then if you're going to live free of those things, you've got to go on and say, okay, God, take me to the next place. What's next in your heart? And I've not given up because of on that sense of collegiality and people who live without ambition and without a drive for significance. And I would say this, and I know probably hundreds of these people around the planet that I get to go hang out with, men and women who know God well, who are in this journey with him, who maybe have had significant positions in the past, but do not have now and are not seeking now, and in fact walked away from those because they could see this very test of power. If it wasn't ruining them, and it mostly does, it was also ruining people around them. And finding a way to walk away from humans' use of power and to try to find... And I'd say, if you're talking to me about spiritual authority, I'll take you to these people. And I can take it all over the planet and say, here's somebody that has real spiritual authority. Doesn't have a business card. Doesn't have a book. Doesn't even have a website that I could say, hey, go read his website. I can't even do that. There are people who just live in the beauty of God's working, and they love the people around them. And they also have impact... often, many, not always, but often beyond their own area, because they've traveled a bit and they've hung out with other people, and other people have recognized the gift of God in their life. And yet it is something that they never take the center place, because they're always putting it back to Jesus. This is him. This is who we're following. It's not me.
Yeah. If you ever lose sight of the fact that this is really about him, this is by him, to him, for him, you know, there's not a him that this isn't a part of. When it starts to become, you know, the golemized me, mine, precious, it's like, yeah, you know what? That's going to absolutely corrupt and destroy. And I don't know. I mean, I think the thing that I've kind of lost clarity or hope in knowing what to do is, when that enters into a system, how do you stop it?
I don't think you can.
I mean, I think that's the part where I do sympathize, because it's like the only way to somehow stop that is to become the very thing you don't want to be. And I'm like, no, I don't want to go in the dark side to stop the dark side.
Yeah, go back to the early days of the Roman Church. You've got this college of bishops, and they have a real sense of collegiality among them. It only takes one who wants to lord over the rest, particularly, and at the beginning, nobody wants to. But as that amasses wealth and property and something and acclaim, now there's people who want more of it than you get. And It only takes one of 12 to pull out a sword and start killing people. Seriously. And that's what they did back then. What's your option? I've, like what you said, I've got to pull out a sword and kill too. I've got to become like you to stop you.
Yeah.
Or I've got to walk away from it all. And then you still may hunt me down and kill me just because you're a threat to what I want to be and do.
Yeah, no, but there still is in me. It's like, no, Jesus, I think you've got a dream and a desire, and your kingdom is not going to be like that.
Well, I would even make that a little better. I would say his kingdom isn't like that. So where you find this happening, this quest for power and struggle, you haven't found his kingdom.
Yeah, you know, I think the one verse that I get totally jazzed about is in Revelation.
The one verse you get totally jazzed about?
It's
not overstated at all.
I got several of those. I thought you would. One verse. The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord in his Christ. I end up going like, oh, yeah, baby, I'm alive. This is going to make it. I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know when, but that's what I'm signed up for.
Yeah.
And that's what I get absolutely jazzed about. It's like, you know what? Somehow in the warped, twisted world that we're in, it gets untwisted and it does come to the finish line and looks and is reflected like in time and space on this earth.
And that is yet future.
Yes, it is not now.
That is yet future.
It's not now.
But I still firmly believe we get to taste that. There are relationships and tasks and things God gives us with people where we get to taste that reality. I think the only problem is we can't preserve that reality.
I agree. But that's where I've been ruined, because I think there's been moments where I'm going like, no, I tasted that. Taste and see approach, going like, okay, I want more of that.
And even where it falls apart, back to, you know, young fellowship groups when I was in middle school and high school as a kid, where you taste genuine spiritual life and reality and you go, man, that is the real deal. Even when that gets twisted and corrupted into something else, it doesn't diminish the reality you got to taste. And that's what people give up. So, well, there's no way to preserve it.
Don't throw that away. You know, for me, those have been the moments where, you know, this is the lens I have understood that. Those are the romantic moments where, quote, the bride of Christ is being revealed. And I'm going like, oh, I'm kind of totally infatuated with that lady. It's like when the body is behaving in that love relationship of it is in a bridal place of he's everything to us.
Yeah.
That, I don't think it is more fun. And it is full of life. It's functional. You don't have these little squabbles of, oh, you know, well, where's my role? In those moments, it's like, it's life is coming from the head and it's touching all the parts. And there isn't this fight for something.
And what I think gets lost, we kind of hinted at it a little bit earlier, is when anything ceases to be a gift, and now it's something I must protect or own or possess, I think that's where it always goes wrong. And unfortunately, there's always somebody around that wants to possess or protect something that's a gift. Now, I used to do that a ton, so I'm not down on people who find themselves there. I've been there. But I have lived for the last 15 years not needing to own anything. And look at everything that I'm involved in. This is a gift that God gives. And if somebody else has to own it, go ahead and own it. I'm really not going to walk with you there. Because I really think from the beginning, these things, when they're real and powerful and effective, it's a gift God gives. And that would be as true as the moment we had in Spain that we talked about last week. I don't go away from that moment saying, man, I know how to do this cross stuff now. I go away saying, that was a gift. Thank you, God. And as often as you want to do that, fabulous. Keep doing it. But I can't make it happen. And there's no way to, you know, make a seminar out of it and run it around the world and try and replicate it.
You can't administrate that. You can be available and hungry. And then, gloriously, Jesus shows up in places. And it's been enough to go, I'm still doing this.
Amen. And I think what I noticed when I was in Rome is that every church these days that calls itself church is a Roman church.
Oh.
It derives the same realities except for those people. And this happens even in churches. There are people...
Pontiff Minimus.
Yes, there you go. Even if the institution has gone awry, almost every place you find believers, you'll find a genuine expression of fellowship and community among people who have hearts in a better place. than worrying about what color carpet we're going to have and whose idol gets to sit
there are
in the front pew.
There are wheat and tares. They're not everywhere, man.
There's what everywhere?
There's wheat and tares.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you do just end up going like, man, I'd love to have a tareless
wheat field. A tareless field. Wheat field would be wonderful.
I haven't found one of those yet.
At the end of the age.
Thank you for traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.